Sandra, in the story about the science of life, there is an interesting turn of thought, quite literally, because everybody has been conditioned to believe in the science of dead matter. They perhaps are not aware of it, they don't know it perhaps explicitly, but still all of the models that they are using in science are based on the study of matter, which was called classical science. Then that extended into the study of molecules, called the theory of relativity, which was based on Einstein's analysis of the Brownian movement, which he called the Zitterbewegung, of the molecules. And then the quantum theory was actually the study of the movement of atoms. And the quantum jump is actually the equivalent of an electron jump within the atom, so it's an electromagnetic theory. And at a deeper level, there is this understanding that underneath the atoms there is something much more fundamental, which we actually cannot describe in that manner. Actually, the Copenhagen Convention sort of got stuck on that because they were not willing to let go of this notion that we need to describe materials in order to understand the creation of the universe as a whole. So when people think of science, in essence they're always thinking of material science, or what I call the science of dead matter, because they are bound to an assumption that what they're dealing with is material and rigid and fixed. And that is also why they came up with this notion that scientific models needed to be verifiable, repeatable and predictable. But when you look at those criteria of verifiability, repeatability, predictability, you can see that actually this means that things are not changing. Things can repeat if they do not change. Things can be predictable if they don't change. Things can be verified if they don't change. So in that sense, it's not just a science of dead matter, but also the science of a closed system, an inert system, invariant system, an unmovable system. Actually, in the traditional terminology, it would be called the system of hell, because hell is the old word for a closed system. Hell from helling off, like in French, enfer from enfermé. If you close it off, nothing can change, and then you are stuck with something that's fixed and rigid. So science, classical science, material science, looked at that a lot and came up with a lot of insight in that. But also they had come to a kind of insight which is only incomplete. So that the understanding that they have is not universally valid. And you can actually experience that when you see how classical science and relativity theory and quantum theory and universal field theory are being used as if they refer to something that is predictable, repeatable, verifiable, and so on. This condition of invariance is actually also at the core of, say, the equations of Newton, when it is formulated as action equals minus the reaction, or the reaction is the opposite of the action. If you toss the equation around, instead of action equals minus reaction, you get that action plus reaction equals zero, which means that you're looking actually at something that will have a zero change. A science, classical science, material science, deterministic science, reductionist science, whatever you want to call it, is based on that assumption, that reduction in thinking, in which change is not allowed into the consideration. The only kind of change that is allowed is that which comes from outside. And then that kind of change is described as created by energy, which is actually exergy, because energy means en ergos, the inner work. But when you look at things in motion, they move because something from outside ex ergos, outside movement, is moving it. It means that in this whole notion of classical material science, there is that incompleteness, that internal activity or internal changes, or let's really straightforwardly call it internal decision taking, is not allowed. It means that material science, classical science, is a kind of slave science, a slavery model. That something from outside, and it doesn't much matter if you call it God, or if you call it universal principles, or if you call it energy, as something from outside will make things change, and things from inside will not do so. If things change from within, for example, a molecule changes, then it is because an electron from outside has been put in motion and creates an internal change within a molecule by which the molecule can then go from one state to the other. It can reorganize itself, restructure itself, but essentially it is only the atoms repositioning themselves because the electrons are taking a different place in that situation. Go a level deeper, look at the atoms, and then you can see that the atoms themselves will change, fall apart, yes or no, due to the change of the electrons within the atom. So again, there will need to be a photon leap somewhere to cause the electrons to change their orbit within that atom, as a result of which the atom activity and reactivity will change. The description, however, is always the same. The material changes will become will have been caused by the molecular changes, which will have been caused by the atomic changes, which will have been caused by, say, the photon leap triggering that change. So even though it is all predictable and verifiable and repeatable, if you can actually operate at that level, it is still no more than there is a change in the quantum field, the photon leap, which will trigger a change in the atom, or the electron leap, which will then change a different flow of the electrons in the molecules, which then will create a different kind of bonding of the molecules in forming materials. It is still a science of dead matter, in which predictability is always the case, and the only reason why people came up with this notion of determinism and indeterminism, a determinism for the material level and indeterminism or probability for the quantum level, was that at that time the model of the positioning and the dynamic of the electrons within the molecules, within the atoms, was not sufficiently clear. Actually, in that model, which was very imprecise, there was an assumption that somehow a neutral and a positive particle will stick together in the core of an atom, and that an electron will hover around it like a planet around a star. Evidently, there's something wrong with that model, because by the principle of electrodynamics, it would be the plus and the minus that would stick to each other, and the zero would be impartial. So if the plus and the zero can stick together, it means that the model is wrong, that there are not little stars with orbiting electrons around it. And actually, tetrionics has solved that by making a model in which the proton and the neutron are actually identical shape structures with different charge distributions at the quantum level, as a result of which the proton and the neutron can stick to each other by strong bond forces of the tetraon surface-surface bonding, which then actually also specifies the location of the electrons within that system. And by the way, the maps of tetraonics do specify that the position of the electrons in these atomic models of, say, a solid state neutron and proton being stuck together is precisely that what had been measured as the Bohr radius and the Schrödinger numbers. What I want to address at this time is that when we make a model and the model is wrong, we need to rethink what we are doing. And most people have an experience with this kind of rethinking. It is called the mourning process, M-O-U-R-N-I-G, which is the sadness or the letting go experience when somebody dies or when you lose something. And we have that same kind of process if we use a model which is not correct. A very famous example of a model which is wrong, but which people believe in, is that of Santa Claus. The children are led to believe, they're actually deceived into believing that there would be a Santa Claus bringing them gifts in midwinter. Then later on they discover that actually it was an intentional deception, that the parents conspired against them on purpose to give them a false understanding which they then need to get rid of. So many people do know that there is this experience of having to let go of a false belief, having to let go of a superstition. But while they are engrossed in this superstition, they are not aware that this is the case, that their belief is false, and that what they strongly are convinced of is untrue. Let me take that one step further, because as we live in the unknown, by definition, as the universe is continuously changing, as there are living beings with freedom of choice, we will always be facing the unknown. That means that we will always have to account for and incorporate in some way the unknown in what we do. But in many cases, the unknown is, as the French call it, the mer à boire. It is too much to take in. So we can only take it in bite size, and then it can well be that what we then interpret is not correct with respect to the whole lot of the unknown which is out there. So we are always dealing with the unknown. We always have to accommodate to the unknown. And by biting off a new chunk of the unknown, we will discover something new. But it will also disprove the old. So in that sense, in all of these kind of discoveries, we are experiencing the kind of transition of the type which we know as New Year's Eve. Actually, it is. It could be a birthday, it could be any day, it could be any moment in time, because every moment in the now here, we are separating from the past, the things that were, and we are stepping into the future, the things that are not yet. And we can only take that step because the future is uncertain, because the future is unknown. In a sense, we can say that we are actually surfing on the waves of time. We are actually participating in specific processes in the universe which we identify with. And as a result of that identification with these processes, we can then surf ahead and say, for example, I can go from one breath to the other, I can go from one meal to the other, I can go from one sip of water to the next, I can go from one step to the next. We are involved in a series of processes which we call our body, which all have their lag time and lead time, as astrology describes. So all of these time-based processes, these cycles operating within us, they have a starting time, a runtime, an ending time, and a time that they need to be switched on or off again. That is what we actually experience in the cell cycle, where the pause phase is the moment that these cycles need to be synchronized, yes or no. And for example, in cancer, that synchronization fails and the cell falls back on its own rhythm and just doggedly keeps on doing that until it no longer functions in the environment. In our body, we are operating these kind of cell cycles, so we are always connected to a process that we that exists, that we know. But while dealing with that process, we can actually navigate into the unknown, a bit like an amoeba who always seeks the food and has to move away from the shit that it puts out. We are moving in the time space of all of these processes in the universe around us, away from the things that we can no longer work with, towards the things that we not know as yet. It does mean that at every moment we are crossing this timeline or this time boundary or this edge of the unknown, like we do in New Year's Eve. And in New Year's Eve we then decide what we will no longer continue to do. For example, the people who decide that they will stop a habit because it no longer serves them. And then they have the choice to put something instead of that habit that they did, which actually helps to get rid of that that undesired habit. Or they can leave the space open for something new to emerge, which actually works as a strange attractor and makes it possible to switch into something new. Because if you replace by the old by something new, which you already decided on, then you do not leave space for newness. So in that sense, it is easier to replace the old habit by, let's call it, a new habit. And it is harder to replace the old habit by the unknown, by keeping that space empty, because that empty space will keep on sucking into activity, and it's quite difficult to actually operate that strange attractor to hold that parking space empty so that nobody stands there, so that actually people can use that as a turning point to get in and out of the parking places, so to say. That empty space is then where you have opened the past and the future into a space called the now. And so in that now you created a domain of suspended animation in which you can then realize that the past is gone, the future is not yet, and you suddenly have this large space for new options to come in. Some people find that very confusing, other people find it very exciting, but at the practical level, it is simply where you can then connect to the universe in a larger sense. If you go only from the day-to-day moment or from the bite-to-bite experience, then you do not have much time, not much space in consciousness to realize that there are other things going on as well. So the moment of Sylvester evening, of the 31st of December, midnight, is that turning point from 1 year to the next. And I actually recommend that you take the Maya calendar because it is tuned in nature. And there you can see that the beginning of the week, the beginning of the month, the beginning of the year are all these kind of events. Same for the beginning of the hour, beginning of the minute, the beginning of the second. Those are turning points where you actually can choose if you want to step into that next cycle, yes or no. But you can also, as the Mayans did, start to understand how all these turning points in these cycles all interconnect, in the same way as the crossing points in a light beam are all interconnected and together have a much larger message than just the switching of the light wave from plus to minus or the other way around. So in this turning point, There is this transition from the unknown to the known, which is the same as that turning point of the new year versus the old year, which is also that transition point of the superstition that you had into something that replaces it. So this is the point where you actually realize that Santa Claus doesn't exist and that people have been fooling you. And it might take a while before you realize that actually these people have been fooling themselves as well. That while they told you a lie, that Santa Claus exists, they in a way, without realizing it for themselves, also told you a truth, which is that as humans, we can help humans. As humans, we can anonymously do acts for the benefit of other people. That as humans, we are actually spirit beings. The Native American Indians, North America, had Santa Claus come from the mountain. These were one of the Katsunas. And the Indians realized that for the spirits to be amongst us, people need to, in a way, make space, get out of the way, out of their body, make space for the spirit to go into their body. So when people play Santa Claus, actually they do the same as these Indians, making an embodiment for this Katsuna possible, that spirit of the Katsuna then acts in their body. So in the use of this Santa Claus experience, people can do good, they can anonymously help people, they can make sure that people feel well, they can also give them honest feedback about what they don't do well, they can support them in very many different ways, and they can give them enlightenment and education or insight in very poetic manners. So in that sense, there is that transition of the unknown into the known, and the other way around, which we are all experienced with, but people still do not understand how it works because they don't pay much attention to it. For example, when somebody dies, people suddenly realize that the contact that they had with that other was never through the body. It was always through the inside. So there too they believed in the existence of Santa Claus, but they forgot about the existence of spirit. They suddenly see the corpse lying there dead, and they don't realize that they actually never had contact with that dead corpse. The body, which was the conveyor or the carrier or the manifestation of that spirit within it. That in their lives they always had contact with that spirit, but they had deceived themselves, they had deceived each other to look in the wrong direction and see the things in the wrong way. They were looking at Santa Claus and presents under the chimney instead of realizing that there is the capacity for people to connect up and supportively help each other. In the process of people dying, a switch needs to be made. In consciousness, in mind, a shift is required in which the now dead person is understood to be dead, and that the living spirit which inhabited that body is no longer there. As I sometimes say, it is in a way indecent to go to a funeral because you know that the one who's been buried is not there. So it's much more worthwhile to let the burial take place and connect to where you know that you felt that being within you. Because the communication that we have between people is like that between mobile phones. We have this radio program, this computer program running within us. It expands by radio waves, and we connect to each other through those radio waves, and those radio wave connections are actually the link that we have with that other being in that other body. And as some people know, and some religious point out, actually many of the religions are based on the realization that we can go out of body. So, for example, in the Pharmacratic Inquisition, which is a study about the effect of the mushrooms on the body, there is a very nice description on how people realize that we can go out of body, so that the body is here, but the consciousness is somewhere else. And so they studied the properties of these mushrooms so that they could better understand how that electrical part of us and the physical part of us connect, but also can disconnect, so that they could get out of this deception, the superstition, that we are dealing with the bodies of the people instead of understanding that we are dealing with the spirit, the intelligence, the consciousness of people. And so when people die, there is this need to internally reorganize the mind and help the mind understand that, yes, there were all these situations where we would meet up with somebody and have that experience with somebody in a specific context, for example, a family setting, or a specific kind of party, or a group that you're a member of whatever kind of settings in which you would meet that specific individual. And after the death of that individual, after the separation of the soul and the body of that individual, you know that you will no longer see that body of that individual in those settings. So your mind needs to, in a way, erase all of the images of that individual for all future expectations of those settings. That's the internal work of the mourning process, where a reduction and editing is done in the memory banks to erase the existence or the presence or the being of that individual in those settings. A lot of people do that process incompletely. They do erase the, let's call it, the future memories of that individual in those settings, and for them it actually feels as if they are ripping out something while they do that, which is that internal process of the mourning, the regret, the sadness, the letting go. But what they could be doing is to change the, let's say, the filing indicators. Instead of the arrow saying, well, this is where we expect this spirit being to be, it now points to where the spirit being actually is. And so instead of looking at the context conditions of where things take place or took place, the reference arrow is now to somewhere where you experience that within you. Many people learn how to do that. So from that moment on, their experience with the deceased, as they call it, is within. So that it doesn't much matter where the other is, because they will know within them how to make that connection. And actually the magical marriage is based on that. Two people meet, and by tuning into each other, they can know where the other is, what the other is experiencing, no matter where the other is. So instead of locking people down together by a wedlock into a closed orbit of having to be together, in the magical marriage, they make this inner union, they recognize each other within, so that they can share their experiences no matter how far they are away from each other. And actually some of the research of the CIA on remote viewing was based on that, that individuals were able to get the social security number of somebody else and then look through their eyes there where they were. So we do all have that capacity. I refer to these kind of capacities because those are the switches that we need to operate when we go from a superstition into a realization. Superstition is when we have a false belief which we created for the simple reason that at that moment we could not deal with reality as it is. So we had to find another way to address that. And this creation of the superstition can be compared to what builders do, what engineers do, in designing and building a house or a bridge. A bridge is probably an easier example. A scaffolding would be built, which is a set of poles stuck together in such a way that they would give the outline of the bridge, but it was known that they were not the bridge themselves. A superstition is a scaffolding. It looks like it, but it isn't it. And a bit like the trellis of a rose fence, or the beanstalk for the bean, the trellis or the scaffolding makes it possible for the the plant to grow higher than the soil, catch more air, catch more light, catch more energy, catch more consciousness experience, and then outgrow itself in a way so that with the support of that scaffolding it can suddenly reach up to where otherwise it could not go. In building a bridge, likewise, the engineers put the scaffolding in place so that the one side of the river and the other side of the river can already connect, that the one side of the abyss and the other side of the abyss can already be joined, even though not yet as a workable bridge. So the superstition gives the understanding that you can get to the other side, but let's say it cannot carry any weight. So the understanding of Santa Claus helps you realize that sharing gifts, good feedback, appreciation are very fundamental human values, but it isn't real as yet. It's only in the setting of that one night of the Christmas Eve. Once people realize that it is only a scaffolding, they can outgrow the scaffolding and realize that actually they are Santa Clauses. They can at any time give people good feedback. At any time they can give people help when they need it. And in that sense, they become the spirit of generosity. Likewise, in the building of the bridge, once the bridge has been built, the abyss can be crossed. So in our lives we have lots of examples where we operate superstitions of different kinds as a kind of stopgap for not yet having been able to build a bridge. And actually in the past, when they started to build bridges in that way, there were quite a number of events where in building the bridge, the bridge and the scaffolding collapsed. So they had to re-engineer it, redesign it, and rethink it, come up with a better solution, better understanding. And now, as you can see all around you, this understanding of building scaffolding and building bridges has been refined to such an extent that in most cases, the bridge is designed and built in such a way that the bridge can be its own scaffolding. And we need to understand that this is not just an engineering technology, but it is also a technology of consciousness. People are more and more aware that the ideas that we first come up with can be thought through much deeper and much better, so that they can actually become workable ideas instead of crummy or clumsy in between half product ideas. When we look at the development of science, we can see that the ideas which were there were superstitions. Most of the models that we know of science of the past are now obsolete. We now know that they do not work, yet they were necessary as scaffolding and as parts of the bridge in order to be able to get from there to here. So we use these scaffoldings as the stepping stones to travel through time from the past into the future. So it's really important to be able to be skilled enough to position those stepping stones there where we can actually use them and where they can give us stability, and where enough of them us can stand there so that we can then take the next step, even though we might have to explore different directions and have different individuals explore that, and out of that comes something which for humanity will work. I want to bring this understanding of this transition from the past to the future, from the known to the unknown, to a deeper level, because I now realize that this is a universal principle. When we are dealing with the transition from last year to the next year in New Year's Eve, or from the past to the future in the moment of the now here, we're actually dealing with precisely the same principle as that what in physics, mathematics, system theory, science in general is called the system boundary, or the boundary. Or if you look at the point in the boundary, it's called the singularity. So that singularity is the point where the system turns inside out on itself, and the unknown and the known connect. So that is the point, let's say, on the edge, the surface of our body, or the surface of our organ, the surface of the sphincter, the surface of the cell, where we turn inside out. And in the cell, we can see that the inside of the cell is you, and the outside of the cell is the universe. But in the cell, there are these four proteins, which actually are the switches, which together define the alchemy by which you can turn inside out, and the universe can turn outside in, and you and the universe, the I inverse, are actually the same. They're connected. They're operated by that transition between the outside and the inside, which is that turning point, which is the same turning point as that between the past and the future, or last year and next year. So in that turning point, in that system boundary, in that singularity of that boundary where things turns inside out, we are dealing with that universal principle of the boundary as it turns inside out on itself. I want to give four examples of that, which everybody knows, but maybe didn't connect up to understand that's always the same principle. One is the example of the wave in water, but mountains on the continent will do the same, and cloud lines in the skies will do the same. These are the wave phenomena where a boundary is being made and changed. A very specific form of that boundary is called the barrier of sound. A well-known example of the same principle is called the barrier of light, and relativity theory refers to that. And what I will now introduce in the conversation is that there is also the barrier of consciousness. And the barrier of consciousness is the one that we need to address when we are talking about Santa Claus and superstitions, when we're talking about paradigms and paradigm shifts, when we're talking about old knowledge and new knowledge in the development of science, and specifically when we're dealing with old beliefs of our old understandings, and the letting go, the mourning process of having to let go of those scaffolding models which do not work. I want to juxtapose these barriers of consciousness, the barrier of light, the barrier of sound, and the wave, because in the wave you can see what happens in the barrier of sound, in the barrier of light, and in the barrier of consciousness. So even though we experience that barrier of consciousness as that tipping point where we sometimes catastrophically feel that things no longer work, that our understanding totally scatters, falls apart, that the scaffolding and the superstition that we held on to actually was fraud. It just doesn't work. It can't do the job. It is not a real bridge. That those transitions at the barrier of consciousness are exactly the same as those at the barrier of light, which have been described by Albert Einstein and others as the light cone. Actually, the light cone is a representation of what happens in the light beam when one light wave connects to the other light wave in the zero point. So the light cone of Albert Einstein is actually half of the light wave going into the zero point, coming out of the zero point in its inverse mode in the beginning of the next light wave. So the light cone, or the event horizon of Albert Einstein, is nothing more than that transition through the zero point in a beam of light. And it needs to be understood that that is only an example of a very much more general principle. And that much more general principle is more easily understood when you realize that the barrier of light is exactly the same as the barrier of sound. There's no difference in the principle. There's no difference in the principle of the barrier of consciousness, the barrier of light, and the barrier of sound. The barrier of sound is in that sense a bit better understood because we can actually go through it. And that was also something which Arthur M. Young described. He was one of the designers of the helicopters. So he invented the helicopter and he had to understand the aerodynamics in it. And he realized that when an airplane goes through the barrier of sound, which is at the speed of sound, which can be calculated and can be measured and so on, that is where the air pressure is pushed together so much that it cannot compress any further, and that that moment the airplane has to move to the through the barrier of sound. And once that is achieved, once that is accomplished, that barrier of sound pops over the airplane with what's called a sonic boom. But as Arthur M. Young described, it is not just that the airplane goes through the barrier of sound, but the barrier of sound also goes through the airplane, which means that the speed of sound in air translates to the speed of sound in all of the materials in the airplane. And if the materials in the airplane have not been calculated to allow for the flow of that process at the speed of sound through those materials will crack. And that's actually how they discovered the barrier of sound, because some of the earlier planes going through the barrier of sound actually fell apart, because as the airplane moved through the barrier of sound and the barrier of sound moved through the airplane, there were bolts or other parts of the airplane which just could not handle those forces, those dynamics, those vibrations, and they fell apart, as a result of which the whole airplane fell apart. It is that dynamic of the airplane falling apart, which is the equivalent of the mourning process, and which is also equivalent to the electromagnetic conversion at the barrier of light. So once you understand that's always the same process, then it is more easy to see what happens in the wave, because when you're in your kayak on the water or with your surfboard on the water and you're floating on the water and the wave comes by, then you have a choice if you want to step onto that wave, yes or no. So you can have the wave go by, or you can step onto the wave and start to surf the wave. And that's how principles, processes, dynamics in the universe connect. And once you make that connection, you actually have one process, you on the surfboard, and the other process, the wave on the ocean, become one system. And you will know that when the wave hits the shore, the wave that carries you will no longer be there. And once you understand that that's a general principle, you are not surprised that when your body reaches a level where, let's call it, you reach a shore, that the soul can no longer serve right in the body. So your understanding is already of a different nature. You're no longer in the superstition that you are your body, but you are in the realization that your body is an entity by itself, like a surfboard or a wave, and that you are an entity in yourself, had the consciousness of your life experience, and that you should not confuse the two. You should not operate the superstition that the one is the other. You should know that they are separate, and then start to understand, as did those religions with the experimentation of the Anagarita mushrooms and other ways to go in and out of body, that you can connect and disconnect from your body, so that you have a consciousness and you have a body, but they're not the same. They're connected, but yet different entities or different kinds of nature. And it is very interesting that when you look at that model of the wave, there is a very typical characteristic description of a wave transition, which you find in a sluice in, for example, a hydro dam, where you have a lake with a lot of water pressure on the one side. You have a tiny hole at the bottom of that dam, and then when you open the sluice, that water comes streaming out in a very specific jet, like a laser beam. Actually, it is a laser principle which is in action there. So when it shoots out straight and narrow like a laser beam with its own internal coherence, it will shoot out until in the environment it touches up on something, and it will have to shift gear, quite literally. A turbulent zone will arise in which vorticity makes a kind of trial testing which velocity does fit in that environment. And then after this turbulent zone, there will be flowing water. And normally, when you actually look at it from a sideways view, you will have the very high level of water on the one side of the dam. You have this layer of shooting water, thin and straight, at the bottom of the bedding. At the other side of the dam, then you have a turbulent zone where the water actually piles up. And then on the other side of this turbulent zone, you have a higher water level, which is flowing slower, but which is actually in balance through this turbulent zone and the shooting water zone with that water in the lake. And those transition descriptions of the pressure of the lake on the one side, the shooting water, the turbulent water, and the flowing water is a universal principle. And once you understand that principle in the model of the water, you can also look for that same principle in the barrier of sound. You just realize that in the barrier of sound, it is much more compact, and that the shooting water is where this barrier of sound actually starts to go into the materials of the airplane. The turbulent zone is where it is then transited into this vibrational state. And then on the other side of it, you have this new state of balance in which the airplane is faster than the speed of sound. So in the size of the aircraft, during this transition going through the speed of sound, you actually have the same principle at work. So you also have the same principle at work in the barrier of light, the speed of light. There you see it as the transition from the maximum of the wave going to the zero point, going into the new wave, which is then the conic of Einstein of the light cone. So there you actually have it as a two Planck distances measure of scale of the universe. So that is where you then know that the thickness of the barrier of light is two Planck distances thick, two quanta thick. But when you go to the barrier of consciousness, you actually realize that the turning of the phase itself takes place in the zero point, and that in the zero point, you're actually working with the flip of the quantum itself. So that the barrier of consciousness is much more precise, are much more defined, much thinner than that of light, that of sound, and that of the wave. But the principle is always the same. I need to bring this up because a lot of people have difficulty in dealing with the unknown. When they confront the unknown and sort of exert their energy into it and discover that it doesn't work, and that the energy that they put into it bounces back to them, they call that anger. Actually, the energy that the creative energy that they put out into the environment is blocked by the environment because it cannot go anywhere. So it piles up between them and the barrier of consciousness or the barrier of the system there where they are. And it piles up in increasing in intensity. And that's what people then experience as anger. But the other way around, if they put energy into the environment and it falls into a void, then suddenly they realize that that the energy that they put out is suddenly lost to them, and it is draining energy from them. So they know that they're actually pulled empty out of the energy that they were trying to put into that dealing with the unusual environment, and that is what they then experience as fear. If you look at that process of anger and fear and aloofness and let's call it respondents, despondency or acceptance, and vitality. Those are described very carefully and very precisely, very well in traditional Oriental medicine. They define that our organs are actually instruments by which we can change the way we interface within our environment. So when we produce energy and it piles up, that's the liver energy associated with anger. When we let go of energy and we realize that we are being drained for energy, that's what called the kidney system and the fear. And when we know that we are actually no longer connected to the environment, but we don't even know how to reconnect, that's the colon energy or the apathy or the despondency, the disconnectedness. And when we know that we are connected, but we can actually make it much more precise, that is called the spleen or the stomach energies, where you're actually being able to position yourself without being able to actively position yourself. And in the heart, you then have that connection between the inner and the outer, plus the capacity to mediate between the two, the song of life. So it's the same barrier of consciousness, or the barrier of light, or the barrier of sound, or the barrier of the system, that wave edge, which we then see working at the organ level. And as Elisabeth Kübler-Ross, transcribing the Tibetan understanding of these processes, then explained, as the Tibetan had described, as was known in the Far East, it is not just that the organs in the body are dealing with these energies in our interaction with the physical world, but these same organs process our interaction with the idea world in the same way. So when we have an idea which doesn't work, we can get angry. If we have the idea that we lose something, then we can have fear. If we have the notion that we don't fit into our environment, we can have the state of depression. If we know that we somehow fit in the environment where we not decide on what we're going to do with it next, we have this feeling of complacency. And when we are in the realization that we form part of our environment and we are in an interaction with it, we have that experience of joy. So Kübler-Ross described, at the moment that people have a loss of some kind, first they will have this phase of disbelief, then they have the phase of shock, then they will have the phase of denial, and then they start to negotiate, and finally they will go in acceptance. It's that same digestive cycle, but described by different terminology. I need to refer to this principle of redressing the fear of loss, because in science we are now at a moment that we are very well aware that the paradigm of science doesn't work. The model of classical science, that everything is predictable, repeatable, and verifiable, has brought us into a state of hell. Products are being made which actually pollute and destroy the planet. Microplastic is already circulating into the microorganisms which are eaten up by the larger organisms, which are eaten up by the larger organisms, and so on. The notion of classical science, that we are outsider observers of this universe, has backfired totally. We are destroying the planet, we are destroying all life forms, we are destroying humanity, and we are destroying ourselves. So something is needed. The superstition of classical material deterministic reductionistic science was an interesting scaffolding, got us to where we are, but now we really need to get rid of that and replace it by something else. So we really need to get rid of this science of dead matter and realize that the science of dead matter only describes the level where we are dealing with the materials in the universe around us. But at the moment that we're dealing with ourselves, with each other, with living beings, we must account for freedom of choice. We must realize that every being is able to do the opposite of what we have in mind. So that the notion of conflict or the notion of disagreement needs to be included in our philosophy, that we need to accept that people are always allowed to have the opposite point of view, so that by comparing the two opposites, we can understand at a different level what the shared experience or the shared intent really is. It's not what you see on the one side of the equation or the opposite on the other side of the equation, the one individual who says yes and the other individual who says no, but that both of them realize that what they say is true for them, but for it to be true for both of them, both need to be able to see why the no is true for the other or the yes is true for the other. And they need to let go of their superstition that it is in the way that they see it. They need to transcend their superstition. And that's precisely why I'm talking about this now, and why I refer to the New Year's Eve, and why I refer to the moment of the now here in the turning point of the present, and why I refer to the Santa Claus effect and the delusion of the deception. Because what we are living now here, much of it is based on the deception and the delusion. Classical science is a deceptive model, it's a false model, it's an incomplete model, because it only deals with dead matter. It ignores life, it ignores living beings, it ignores humanity, it ignores us. But the interesting part is that once you understand the complementarity of things, then you can find that everything that has been described for classical science did not describe reality around us, but described a specific aspect of realization within us. And so all of the descriptions that we have of so-called reality are descriptions or formulations of our form of realization when we are interacting with dead matter. We need to add to that the realization that there are many points within us where we can make different choices, where we can actually choose the opposite. And then we can understand that the science of dead matter and all of the models that we have of the dead matter philosophy, let's call it the philosophy of death, is valid for that part of the universe which is invariant by the assumption of science itself. But we can add to that the insight that within that reality there are turning points, there are swivel points, there are pivot points, switches where things can do something else, where they can actually do something opposite. And that in the science of life, we can make use of that scaffolding of the science of dead matter or the science of death, and bring that to life by looking for the turning points where things could be otherwise. At the moment, computer circuits are being built in such a way that they cannot do anything else than specified by the designer. But in our biology, we see that the circuitry in our body has been designed in such a way that it can go from one option to another, to another, to another. There are actually four ongoing different level processes in our body. One is physical, one is chemical, one is electromagnetic, one is pure consciousness. And they are separate yet connected within us. And in the science of life, we can see that all of the knowledge that we have from classical science, material science, dead science, science of death, we can use, but we can bring to life by realizing that there are hidden potentials within it, which we haven't looked at. We can understand that the science of life was not a superstition and a deception, or better said, a self-deception, which we need to divorce from in a traumatic experience. No, we need to realize, we can realize, that it's actually half of the story. It's like the photograph, and now we can put it into motion to see the film. We can now see that from the one picture of the photograph to the next picture of the photograph, there's actually a third photograph, which could also be possible. And so that suddenly we have more than one way to enter into the future. We have more than one way to see how dead and alive is connected. We have more than one way to see how matter and consciousness is connected through that principle of the water wave, the sound wave, the light wave, and the wave of consciousness. And that as a result, we are now able to make the paradigm shift of science, of humanity, of consciousness, and step beyond the limitation of that model that everything would be dead and predictable, and that humans have to behave as robots, and that society has to be looked at as if a machine, that nature and biology has to conform to our demands, or otherwise we'll poison it in one way or the other. We can actually come to understand that what permaculture shows is that all of these life forms have been in balance with each other for millions of years. Humans interfered with that process, so humans need to stop interfering with it. They need to get the funny glasses off their nose. They need to get that strange belief system, science of dead matter, out of their system, and then they can see that in us and around us has always been connected, and that our body helps us understand how that connection takes place, that the body is actually the gearbox between, let's call it, the past and the future, and that with our mind we are actually able to potentialize or to optimize that transition between the past and the future by taking more space between them. Which is traditionally called meditation. If you stop replacing what you did by something else, and if you wait to see what else is going on there, then suddenly you can see that there are patterns which have already been taking place, which you never turned on. That in a way you've been doing all kind of things, which if you had stopped doing them long time ago, such as worry about what will happen, or stress about things not going the way you want, then you can see how things are actually taking place, and then you can reposition your surfboard accordingly to where the waves actually are going. And then instead of going straight towards your goal, you might have a wave which goes faster in a different direction, and then you switch waves and take the other wave to go to where you wanted to end up. And maybe you realize that where you thought that you needed to end up is only another delusion, which you need to divorce from in a non-traumatic way as well. Go through the mourning process by making a transformation process, and realize that always we will be blocked by our reflexes, and we will be blocked by our superstitions, which is inevitable. Because that is the child steps that we can take to go from the unknown to the known. But the more space we take to look at what's actually going on within us and around us, the more we can see the connection and the more we can realize that we are the connection. So I had to bring quite a number of ideas together to show that in the transition of the paradigm shift that we have in science now, and actually tetrionics is the turning point in that. Tetrionics shows what material, mechanistic, classical, deterministic science actually is and shows and how it works up to the deepest level. It actually shows that from the smallest level down, we can now reconstruct all of physical reality and see that all of physical reality in a way is a machinery, and that the science of dead matter has in a way brought to its conclusion. It is now possible to see how quanta actually build and redefine DNA, genetic material. The other side of that story is that in tetrionics there is this understanding, this fundamental understanding, that it is all about the ability to flip a quantum. Our body is able to do that, cells are able to flip a quantum, as a result of which they are able to flip a charge, they'll flip the polarity of a boundary, and thus thereby they can open and close a boundary. They can do that at the cellular level, at the organ level, at the body level, and we do it in the social humanity interactional level. And that is where we then can see that the model that we have is deadly, because it's actually a model of dead matter. It is a model of death, and as a consequence, it evidently can only be deadly. But when we understand where the lack of understanding is, or where the lack of specificity is, then we can see where the options are for something else to happen. And then we get away from the predictability, the repeatability, and the verifiability into the creativity. As we can see where the lacunations are in the reality that we have, we can see where we can step into that reality and be the switch by which we can turn it into something else. That we can see our active participation in creation, and that we can learn to operate freedom of choice as creators in creation. So the moral of the story is that there is no need for sadness about the wrongness and the incompleteness of the model that we had. Actually, there is a great cause for joy, because thanks to that model, we now have basically everything in place to realize that that model was wrong, but also that we can set it right. So we don't have to go into a traumatic mourning process of rejection of the old model. We just need to see that it is the scaffolding for the new model. And that even though the old model sort of has condemned life on the planet to the zero point of death, that zero point is actually also the turning point in which dead and alive can swap into each other. It's the quantum pivot, it's the polarity pivot, it's the balance pivot, and it's the pivot between connecting and disconnecting. And then you can see the essence of life at all levels. And thanks to the model that we have, we can then very quickly, very specifically and precisely see why freedom of choice is so fundamental, and how important it is to learn to operate freedom of choice. With, of course, the counterpart that as this is about freedom of choice, as is about things which cannot be predicted, as it is about things which cannot be specified, because in the zero point it is zero, it's not the one, it's not the other, it is what it is not, and that is what it is. And once we understand that, we can learn how important our freedom of choice is individually and collectively. And that, as in the story of Santa Claus, when we help each other to understand that, we can very quickly, let's say, explosively, come to an explosion of consciousness in which we see how we can optimize the choices that we have individually together. so that we can cooperate and collaborate as an organism with all other life forms, as is already described in permaculture, and that in a way the only thing that we need to do is take off the blinkers so that we can see the reality as it is. And that, of course, is a very powerful experience, that we can wake up from the sleep of this hypnosis that life would be dead, and instead realize that everything is dead, is the sounding board, is the musical instrument, is the canvas in and on and by which we can bring things to life.